Hello, I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our Editor-at-Large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And our Contributing Editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
This week, we've got a lot of notable new films to review, including sci-fi noir Reminiscence, G.I. Joe spin-off Snake Eyes, video nasty horror Censor, The Night House, Pig, and making the leap from the small screen to the big screen is People Just Do Nothing. But before we start on those, what have you guys been watching this week?
I've actually managed to get around to watching a film I've wanted to watch for ages. It's one of these films you have in the back of your mind that you've always wanted to see, and you know, you build it up in your head. It was this 1990, I think it was, road movie from Britain. I mean, British road movies don't really exist, which is, I think, why I really wanted to see it. It's called Soft Top, Hard Shoulder, and it was written by Peter Capaldi and stars Peter Capaldi and directed by Stefan Schwartz, who went on to do Shooting Fish. Really random choice, but yeah, quite enjoyed it. Quite interesting that Capaldi wrote it very early in his career. Very early appearance of Jeremy Northam as well, who plays his kind of flatmate. And quite a few nice little cameos. Richard Wilson pops up, for example. So, yeah, it's finally come out on Blu-ray after years of not being available. So, yeah, that's what I've been watching this week.
It's funny you should say that, James, because it must be the week of the Brits, because for anyone listening last week, I answered this question that I'd been going back to all the old Ealing comedies and rewatching them. So I finished those off, the last few I had to catch up on. So I did Lady Killers, Kind Hearts and Coronets, Lavender Hill Mob, all of which were obviously terrific. Hadn't seen them for about 20 years. And then I carried on with the British theme and just rewatched a few Brit classics that, again, I haven't seen for a few years. So the big one was With Now and I, which is a film I've seen, like most of us, many, many times, but probably not for about 10 years. And it just gets better with age. It just gets funnier and sadder, more melancholy. That ending gets me every time. And then I watched Hot Fuzz again. It had been a little while, so yeah, there was just, I was watching it on my own in the living room, and there's about five moments in that film that just made me howl with laughter, just completely sat on my own. Just, yeah, very, very funny. Really enjoyed it.
That is a nice combo, Hot Fuzz and With Now in the same week. Did well.
Yeah. And what about you, Matt?
The main thing I've been watching this week, besides the obviously this week's films, are a sort of random British sitcom of recent years, keeping up the British theme again, called Motherland. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and it's I'd kind of heard about it. I thought I would relate to it somewhat. And I just needed that. You know, when you just need a light wind down kind of sitcom in the evening before you go to bed, that was what I needed. I picked that at random, started watching the first series of that, and yeah, I've been enjoying it. Yeah, it's not groundbreaking or anything like that, but it's very good fun.
But yeah, very enjoyable. I've seen it up. The recent season just came out not that long ago. And well, I think Lucy Punch is great as the sort of slightly demonstrative mother. Really enjoy that show.
Okay, so now on to the week's new film releases then. Let's look back and remember what it was like to watch an original big budget sci-fi.
When the waters began to rise and war broke out, nostalgia became a way of life. There wasn't a lot to look forward to. So people began looking back. Nothing is more addictive than the past.
No, put me back. I understand.
She's moved on, and you should too.
People don't just vanish.
To find where she'd gone, I had to know where she'd been.
So that was Reminiscence. James, set Reminiscence up for us, please.
So Reminiscence is set in the near future in Miami, a Miami that's been flooded. There's water everywhere, basically. There's been a war as well. The main character, played by Hugh Jackman, Nick Bannister, he is a sort of a detective of the mind, I suppose you could say. He has clients who rather like to indulge in the past, and he has a sort of gizmo called the tank, which he can kind of immerse them in and hook them up to. And this sort of projects their past memories in a sort of 3D hologrammatic form. These people sort of pay for this service. They're almost sort of nostalgic for a time when life was better, when there wasn't floods and wars and what have you. That's kind of his job. He works with Tandaway Newton's character, Watts. They have this kind of lucrative little business going. But then inevitably, the classic femme fatale walks into his life. Her name is May, played by Rebecca Ferguson. They become embroiled in a sort of love affair. And then it turns out her past memories indicate some pretty violent stuff. She then sort of disappears, and it leaves him completely obsessed from there on, trying to find out really what's behind her, and he can't let go, basically. That's kind of where we start off with Reminiscence, but it goes on from there.
So, Jamie, did you actually like this film?
Not massively, to be honest with you. Yeah, I obviously wanted to like it. I'm so for studios taking a punt on new material and big budget kind of ideas driven, not based on IP. I think we all want to see that. So I really wanted to like it. And it's directed by Lisa Joy, who is Christopher Nolan's sister-in-law and was the co-creator of Westworld. So she obviously has, serious form there that you hope for something. But I just found it didn't quite work for me, that thing of being set in the future, but being a film noir and having all those tropes with a femme fatale and the sort of hard-boiled dialogue. And, obviously it can work. You can have future set sci-fi that has a sort of past feel to it, be it something like Brazil or even Star Wars. The original Star Wars has a slightly clunky feel to it, and Alien, obviously everything's a bit industrial. But in this one, it didn't quite work. And the CGI I found really off-putting, that you have all these sort of shots of Miami where half of it is underwater. And it just felt very pixelated to me, that you're really aware you're watching CG, which I always don't like in a film when it kind of takes you out of it, that you can really see its computer effects. So I wasn't ever really in that world and in that mystery. I did like Rebecca Ferguson. I think she's terrific. And as a femme fatale, she's kind of made for that role, twisting and turning everyone's minds and kind of seducing people and playing with them. So that was fun. But overall, the film didn't do it for me.
James, you liked it a little more, didn't you?
Yeah. Funny enough, some of the elements that Jamie didn't like, I kind of did like, the sort of blending of sci-fi and film noir. I thought kind of worked for me. I will fully admit it feels quite derivative in some capacity. It reminded me of The Matrix at times. But then again, which sci-fi hasn't been influenced by The Matrix in the last 20 odd years. I wasn't actually that keen on Rebecca Ferguson, funnily enough. I thought she was a little bit one note. I mean, you're completely right. She's totally made for that femme fatale kind of role. It's perhaps more in the writing than her performance. It was a little bit one note. I quite like seeing Hugh Jackman playing a sort of morally questionable character. I mean, he's not a sort of gilt-edged hero here. He's not the greatest showman, shall we say. I quite enjoyed that, to see him delve into the past. I mean, interestingly, talking of his relationship to the Nolan wider family, he did The Prestige a few years ago. I mean, I'm not putting this film on the level of The Prestige, obviously, but it's interesting that he's kind of come along and played these two different roles for the Nolan family. And the CGI, I will grant you, isn't the best. It's been done on a lower budget. But then I really like, for example, the sort of 3D holograms of the memories. I thought they were really well done, and the way they were sort of projected and people were kind of like immersed in them. I kind of feel like there are lots of good ideas in there. Perhaps on a higher budget, it would have come off better. But again, as you said, Jamie, it's a sort of a original studio movie, and they don't really come along that often anymore. And I kind of have to sort of tip my hat to Lisa Joy for at least attempting something, original.
Definitely. Yeah. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, I felt sort of somewhere in the middle, probably, as after them, but that I've got to say, like, full disclosure, that I interviewed Lisa Joy and Hugh Jackman for a feature in the magazine a couple of months ago. And when I interviewed them then, I hadn't literally seen anything of the film, like the trailer wasn't even out at that point. So I was kind of going in very blind to the interview. I really was trying to will myself to like it a bit more, I think, because of this original aspect that we've spoken about and the fact it is something new. It's trying to do something a bit different. It's not a franchise. And the thing I liked most about it really was this kind of world building. I saw it on the big screen, and I actually really liked the sort of opening shot you get of Miami, where it's kind of, half submerged. And I personally in my cinema viewing, I just didn't really feel like, oh, that's really pixely. I thought it was actually pretty good CGI then, to me. And I liked the idea of this world, and because it's so hot, everyone kind of, you know, comes out at night and sleeps during the day. That's the kind of idea. So that was kind of a nice sort of twist on the noir as well. But then there's a few sort of silly bits that I won't kind of go into for spoilers, but there was a few times I just felt it just got a bit silly and just didn't quite work, and not everything just kind of gelled together. And it's one of those films that by its nature, just there's a lot of exposition. There's just a lot of people kind of, you know, explaining things that have happened before, explaining how things work in this, you know, new world, rewatching old memories of people, you know, just re-going over the same ground, you know, to try and find new clues and things like that. Yeah, so it kind of just didn't entirely work for me. I found some of the dialogue just a bit too ripe, like that memories of pearls on the necklace of time or something did sort of clunk a bit for me early on. But, you know, if you can kind of embrace that, you know, I must say, I know some people who really dislike it, like such as Jane, the editor of Total Film, who normally hosts, who's on holiday this week. She really, really strongly disliked it. So I kind of went in with diminished expectations in a sense. It was okay to me, just not great, not what you'd hope for, really, I suppose, from this kind of cool idea, big star, you know, director with sort of Westworld experience.
One of my problems with it, like James mentioned, The Matrix, and it is unfair to compare films to these classics, but I'm about to do the same, that it reminded me, even though they're very different in some ways, but it reminded me of Minority Report, and it reminded me a little bit of Strange Days as well, the Catherine Bigelow film. Just that whole thing of sort of, you know, stuff in the mind coming to life and sort of memory clips and seeing things and these holograms of past memories. It felt in a similar world. And just like I said, it's unfair, but comparing it to those two films, you know, they are streets ahead, and it never quite gelled for me.
You have to sort of tip your hat though to Lisa Joy, in the sense of her husband obviously wrote the short story that Memento was based on. And given this is obviously a film that deals with memory, you've got to have some cojones, as they say, to kind of try and make a film about memory when you're connected to the Nolan family. So I sort of admire her for that.
Yeah, that's something again that I was sort of mixed on, because anyone who's listened to this before obviously knows I'm a huge Christopher Nolan fan. There's very much a sort of Nolan tone to it, I would say, in that, to me, Inception was saying it reminded me of, and there's a couple of sort of shots of when you see Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson in sort of happier times that really look like the sort of scenes where Leonardo DiCaprio and Marion Cotillard are sort of, you know, enjoying their time in the sort of that world they create, that they sort of escape into. There's something sort of Inception about the idea as well, in the sense that you're kind of going into people's minds and kind of getting things from there. And, you know, there's this sort of detective character, you know, with a past who's trawling through memories. So in a way, I kind of like, I like seeing someone attempt to do a Nolan-y film more than just any kind of just completely generic blockbuster or franchise film or whatever. But then at the same time, I just couldn't help thinking, like, come on, this is like no Inception, this is clearly sort of Nolan light, you know. I just couldn't shake that feeling. So yeah, that was a kind of mixed bag, the fact that it sort of evoked that for me. So Reminiscence there, a bit of a mixed bag, but you can see it for yourself when it's out in cinemas this Friday, 20th of August. Okay, now time to rewind back in time for this nasty little number.
This depiction is dangerous.
Come on, Enid.
I'm cutting it.
Butchering, sadism, murder.
A wave of depraved and corrupt horror video.
Mirror. Confusing fiction with reality.
Doug Smart, producer, Ident Investment Films.
Maybe Enid could watch my latest Frederick North submission. Wanted a woman's eye on his film.
So that was Censor. Jamie, what is Censor about?
So it's set in the mid-80s, 1985, and it is about a censor called Enid, who is played by Neve Algar, we join her as she's in a subterranean kind of room. It's a bit like the BBFC, but it's not the BBFC. And she's censoring all of these horror films that are coming through. It's the age of the video nasty. So she sits there day after day watching screams and murders and rape and mutilation. And she's very fastidious about her job. She's quite buttoned up and she feels she's protecting the public. So she's making these notes and really has a problem with all the kind of sexualized violence towards women that she's seeing in all of these films. One day she sits down and watches a film called Asunder, which is another low budget exploitation film. And it really triggers something in her that it kind of goes into the woods and she recognizes these images and it brings back memories from her own past, that when she was a young girl, her and her sister went into the woods. Something happened. Her sister disappeared and is now presumed dead many, many years later. And she has kind of censored this memory from herself. She's buried it in her mind and obviously has this terrible trauma over it. And this film, it's almost like it knows something. Like, how does the director know what happened? You know, was he the culprit? It's like really weird. So then she takes it upon herself to start investigating this film and trying to sort of dig into her own past to see if there's any sort of link.
So, James, all very intriguing. Did you like this film?
Yes and no would be my honest answer. What I really liked about it was, as sort of Jamie described, this mid-80s setting in this sort of world of film classification. Sort of production design behind that, for example, is really good. And the director, who's a sort of first-timer, Prano Bailey Bond, she completely nails this era of the kind of video nasty. You know, for example, they're all in their offices smoking, and it just really reeks of atmosphere, that first half. And I really enjoyed that. The lead actress is fantastic as well, all the way through. You've also got Michael Smiley, who turns up as a film producer, isn't he? He's kind of particularly sleazy. He's great. I mean, there's lots of great elements about it. I found the sort of second half, and I won't go into too much about it, didn't quite work for me. This sort of search for the sister, we can probably leave it at that. That I didn't find as compelling as the sort of setup. But from an atmospheric point of view, it completely crackles as a film.
How about you, Jamie? Did you sort of enjoy it all the way through? Or
I absolutely loved it, actually. I can sort of see what James is saying, that, you know, maybe the first half is a little bit stronger than the second, but I by no means think it tails off. What does happen in the second half that I think we can say without giving too much away is it starts to kind of blur reality and fantasy in a very similar way to what Barbarian Sound Studio did a few years ago. In terms of she's seeing all of this trauma every day. Not only does she see these films with all this violence towards women, but just in the general workplace, you know, in the 80s, she faces sexism, misogyny all day long, and all these little cracks start to appear and she begins to kind of lose it, basically. So the second half blurs reality and fantasy, which I think it does really well. I loved it. I think as a study of trauma, it's great. Like James said, it really evokes the period. You doesn't go too much into it, but you got all the politics of the time with, you know, Thatcher's government and the miners' strikes. And, you know, it's almost like at the time they were using the video nasties to kind of deflect from the real problems in society at the time. I just think it captures it really, really well. And again, like James said, the lead performance is great. You know, I'd really, really recommend it. For me, it's probably the film of the week. We've got some good ones to come, but yeah, I loved it.
Is it actually scary?
I wouldn't say scary. It's not a horror movie that, you know, you get certain Friday night horror movies like The Conjuring, which wants to sort of get you with jump scares and give you a thrill ride and get the popcorn flying in the air as you shriek. And it's not one of those movies. It's very, very slow burn, atmospheric. It's not like the video nasties. Like if you watch the video nasties from the 80s, a lot of them are cheap and exploitative and not very good. And this is quite art house and it's quite classy. But I think the word I would use for it is unnerving and disturbing rather than scary. You know, the atmosphere is terrific.
Yeah, I can't say I found it that scary. But, you know, again, not all horror films are necessarily meant to be, you know, all out scary. And yeah, as Jamie said, this is quite unnerving sort of atmosphere wise. Yeah, I just felt like I wished it had ramped it up slightly in the second half. I suppose it's different kind of film, but St. Maud last year had a sort of similar ripple effect. I mean, you know, people have really celebrated rightly St. Maud as well. And interesting, they're both female filmmakers behind them as well. I mean, that's something to be celebrated and something we haven't seen a great deal of in terms of horror movies being directed by women. So both impressive pieces of work in different ways. I feel like what Prano Bailey Bond does next, I think everyone, well, a bit like with Rose Glass, everyone's going to be completely agog to see what these guys do next, because they're both extremely talented filmmakers.
Yeah, I think she's a massive talent, and she's also someone like Rose Glass. You can tell when a horror filmmaker loves and understands the genre. You know, Prano Bailey Bond has been a fan of horror movies since she was 7. When she started watching them, she's watched a great deal of the Video Nasties and all the other horror films that have come along over the years. And you really get that while she's critiquing this genre, she also really adores it. And I think that's important.
I feel like I wanted to see more in the classification department, though. I think I found that fascinating, and because we've never really had a film set in the world of film classification, which is an extremely nerdy thing to even want. But I really like that side of things. You mentioned Barbarian Sound Studio earlier, which to me is one of the great horrors of the last few years. I mean, I don't think this quite matches up to that, but you know, it makes a pretty credible effort, that's for sure.
I think also for people in the know, just talking about the British Board of Film Classification, even though this isn't set in the BBFC, probably for legal reasons, they couldn't do that. She's just a censor. It definitely takes its cue from that. And if you go to their building and, you know, it is lots of sort of subterranean corridors and stuff like that. So it's really effective in the film that as they're walking down these concrete tunnels, you can hear the screams echoing. You know, it's great. And then in these dingy little rooms, you've got people smoking away with their notepads, you know, watching terrible traumatic movies. So, yeah, it was great fun.
So that was Censor. And if you fancy seeing that, it's out in cinemas from this Friday, 20th of August. Right. So now just time for an alternative line reading where someone does a famous film quote in a silly accent. And we have to see if we can guess what the film is when they're trying to throw us off. And this week it's Jamie's turn. So Jamie, hit us with your film quote, please.
Okay. I don't even know what accent this is. I make it up on the spot. It's not really an accent. It's just a silly voice. So here we go. Hey, she's a Catholic, man. They're all like that. You want to get yourself laid, you've got to get yourself Protestant. Any ideas?
Is that like something from The Commitments or something?
No, you see, I'm throwing you off with my cunning accent here, which I don't know what it is. It's probably a very dodgy accent, to say the least. But, right, Matt Mason, you said to me last week, play the player, not the question, or something like that.
Yes.
So do it that way. Think of a film I adore.
Is it a PTA film?
It's not, but that's a good effort because I do adore PTA.
Stand By Me?
It is Stand By Me. Stand By Me, and it's Kiefer Sutherland. There's a scene where they're getting homemade tattoos. They're just digging into each other's arms with a knife, with a penknife, and he's just talking to his rough mates. One of them's complaining that he's been seeing someone for 2 months and he hasn't got very far with her, hasn't got past first base. And that's what Kiefer as Ace Muriel replies.
She's a Catholic, man. They're all like that. If you want to get laid, you got to get yourself a Protestant.
Let's hope Kiefer's listening to hear that that reading of his work.
I think he'd be astonished and he'd be glad I wasn't around at the time to take that job from him.
Right. And moving swiftly on, it's time for another big summer blockbuster. Let's roll the dice on this one.
Into your eyes, and I saw honor.
I owe you. We are going home.
I don't have a home.
Not yours. Mine.
So that was Snake Eyes, G.I. Joe Origins. James, who is Snake Eyes?
Well, first of all, he's played by Henry Golding. This is obviously based on the Hasbro toy line, comic line, etc. We've already had a couple of G.I. Joe films in the past. I'm sure you're very familiar with Rise of the Cobra and Retaliation. This is obviously, as it says in the title, an origin story. Snake Eyes is a sort of martial arts expert. His father has been was sort of murdered when he was a boy, and he's basically out for revenge. And he gets sort of inducted into a kind of Yakuza clan, basically as he's sort of trying to sort of seek out the person that killed his father all those years ago. And that's kind of driven him for revenge. This clan sort of brings him to Tokyo, where sort of a lot of the film takes place. And yeah, it goes on from there.
This was one of those films for me where I went in with probably low expectations because, as you mentioned, I really wasn't a fan of the first two G.I. Joe films. To be honest, I can barely remember them, but I just remember them being extremely sort of plasticky, just kind of really lame action films, basically, that, you know, never really seemed to quite launch the franchise they were hoping for. So I sort of went in with low expectations on this, but I actually really sort of quite enjoyed it. And I don't know sort of, yeah, how much that was down to sort of lowering those expectations, but I thought Henry Golding was very good. It was an interesting kind of world it was set in, you know, like you say, with the Yakuza and going to Japan, just gave it a really different sort of flavor to a lot of the sort of blockbuster films we see like this. There was some really nice action in it. I thought there was a lot of good fights, a lot of, you know, good samurai sword action. And Henry Golding was a really sort of solid protagonist, and you warmed him. And it's a lot of it kind of comes down to this relationship he has with Andrew Koji's character, Tommy, who, you know, we know goes on to become Storm Shadow in the comics and toys and cartoons, etc. So, you know, there's going to be some sort of simmering tension there, but the film's kind of based around the fact that they sort of have this bond, and then Tommy kind of brings him into his sort of family clan to sort of train him up after Snake Eyes has sort of saved his life. Overall, I generally hit the right kind of beats for me. I just thought it sort of worked well for what it was. And I really liked it. I'd be up for another.
It's quite an interesting role for Henry to take, having done Crazy Rich Asians, of course, which I guess is the thing that propelled him into the Hollywood sort of firmament. Did you think he really worked as a sort of major league kind of action hero?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, I thought he was convincing in the action stuff. Like there was quite a lot of times you could see he was clearly involved. Obviously, he must have had a stunt double come in, you know, now and again for some of the action. But yeah, I actually thought he kind of convinced. And obviously, he's so far we've sort of mainly, you know, like I say, Crazy Rich Asians and then the Paul Feig films, A Simple Favor and Last Christmas. He obviously very much plays it charming, but I did buy him as a character with a bit more edge and sort of, you know, a real chip on his shoulder because of his past and kind of carrying this sort of, you know, trauma from his dad being killed when he was very young. And I sort of bought it, but then he also had enough charm that you kind of did want to sort of stick with him. He has a few sort of funny lines. So this to me was like, yeah, he's on his way to being a star, I think, with this.
And then you've got Robert Shvenka directing it. Who's kind of one of those journeyman directors, yeah. I've always thought. I mean, he's done stuff like, that sounds terribly rude, but he's done stuff like Flight Plan and Red and is it pronounced Ripped or R.I.P.D.? I've never managed to
think it's
R.I.P.D.,
isn't it?
Yeah. Then a couple of the Divergent movies he did as well. So he's got a sort of solid track record without ever being amazing, I guess. Yeah. But he seems well suited to something like this.
Perhaps that was another reason why I had lower expectations. And I suppose what you would say, you know, kind of against the film in a sense is if you are a big fan of, you know, martial arts movies and samurai movies and, you know, if you saw Villainess in recent years and things like that, you may find, you know, the action a bit tame or a little bit derivative. And it's because it's obviously a family film, it's quite bloodless. If you're a huge fan of these films already, there might be elements of it you're like, oh, come on. But in its own terms, as a way to sort of refresh the G.I. Joe franchise, it really worked, I thought.
I didn't manage to see that one, but I was really surprised by the trailer that I saw that, and it really sold it to me. But like you, I really didn't like the first two G.I. Joe films, and I saw the trailer and Henry Golding, I thought, looked really charismatic and the action looked good in the trailer, and I thought, oh, actually, I want to see that.
So it probably benefits from being like a dark horse in a way, I'd say, you know. So perhaps almost it's one of the things that I then start worrying that if I get your expectations up too high. But yeah. For me, it was definitely what I would call like a real sort of pleasant surprise out of the summer blockbusters for me. I just had a lot of fun with it. Anyway, that's Snake Eyes, which is actually out now. So if you want, you can go and see it right away. Find out if you agree with me. After that, time for something a bit lighter with the Corrupt FM crew.
Corrupt FM was one of the biggest pirate radio stations in the whole of Brentford, yeah? Like,
it was the only one in Brentford.
It was the only one in Brentford, that's what I mean, so it was the biggest.
It's not easy managing Corrupt. Any sane manager would have quit a long time ago, but not me.
But apparently the music is being used on a TV show in Japan.
It's bloody batshit mental, mate!
So that, of course, was People Just Do Nothing, Big in Japan. What's the story of this big screen spin-off of the TV comedy?
Well, first of all, for anyone who doesn't know, the TV version, it ran for, I think it was five seasons from 2014 to 2018. And it's about Corrupt FM, who are a pirate station who play UK garage and drum and bass out of Brentford. And this big film version, it's 3 years later. The manager of a band is living out of his van. You know, nothing's really happened. And then suddenly they hear that one of their tunes is massive in Japan because it's being used in a game show. And it's, you know, a typically zany Japanese game show. And whenever anyone has something terrible happen to them, like it's one of those shows where they're always falling in pools of slime and getting hit with sticks and stuff. And whenever anyone kind of face plants, they play this song from the band where it's like going like boom, bang, like, you know, falling down, whatever. So it's a massive hit in Japan. So essentially they're invited to go out to Japan and meet their audience and do a massive concert in Japan in front of thousands of people. So the boys go out there and it's just a culture clash comedy, really. But they're out there and the Japanese marketing people are trying to turn them into a boy band and sort of give them a makeover and give them costumes. And they have to learn dance moves to perform on the stage. And it's that age old thing of like, you know, do we sell out? Do we stay true to who we are? And then, like I said, a massive culture clash comedy. That they hate all the Japanese food. They go to McDonald's, you know, all of those kind of things. So yeah, that's the film.
Were either of you actually familiar with the TV show before you saw the film?
I've become familiar with it relatively recently. And, you know, it had been recommended to me a few years ago and I'd sort of tried to get into it and then did get into it much more recently. And I have to say, I really enjoy the show, first of all. Mm. So I did have, I suppose, reasonably high expectations for the film. And I think what I really liked about the film is it doesn't sort of pollute the style of the show. It's still done in this kind of mock documentary style. Although they do obviously go to another country, they don't adjust the style of the show whatsoever, or it translates reasonably well into a sort of cinematic experience. I think it really did manage to keep the spirit of the show alive very, very well. I think that what really works about the show is how sweet the characters are. They're kind of like big kids, really. And there's a sequence where the two main characters, MC Grindr, as he likes to be called, and DJ Beats, this is where they're at this sort of Japanese game show. And they're all sort of made to wear these kind of ridiculous onesie kind of outfits. And they get into this kind of ridiculous kind of fight where they're sort of fronting up to each other. An MC Grindr, he's kind of like, come on, you've got to hold me back. And when, of course, no one's holding him back. And he looks completely ridiculous. And they get into this sort of playground fight, basically. And it just immediately takes you back to those kind of relationships you had when you were a kid with friends. And that's what translates really well from the show to the film is, as I say, they're just these big kids with sort of big dreams that haven't really quite worked out. But in the film, it's probably the closest they get to the music industry. It's the closest they get to sort of fame and celebrity. And I thought that worked really well as an idea.
The TV show was quite a big hit. It started off as just online shorts and then they became popular enough that, you know, a TV show was commissioned and it was on BBC Two and BBC Three, like I said, for five seasons. And it has quite a big following. So it's quite natural that this film came about. And like James, I quite enjoyed it. I found it quite funny. I mean, the mockumentary musical, it's always going to be compared to Spinal Tap. And obviously it's not in the same class as that. How can it be? But I did find this film enjoyable. It made me laugh a lot. There's a lot of juvenile humour. Like James said, they're just big kids. And, you know, when they first get dropped off at the hotel, the bellboys come out to sort of take their suitcases. And they're like, oh, bellboys, that sounds like Bellend, you know. And it's that kind of humour, among other things.
Which we're all laughing at right now, so...
I mean, it is very juvenile, but there's other kinds of humour as well. But But I also found it strangely touching at the end. So I think if you're a fan of the show and you want to go back into that world, you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, because I came to it completely cold, having not seen the show at all. And I was sort of surprised how I kind of, you know, got into it from there. And like you say, literally, like, juvenile is very much the word. You know, there's a lot of immature humor. But, you know, when you're in the right mood for that, I did snigger along a lot. Yeah, and I got weirdly sort of engaged with the characters much more so than I was expecting, you know. So, that it was another pleasant surprise for me this week.
What's interesting as well is a couple of years ago, they actually commissioned a US remake that they were going to do it set in Las Vegas. And I think it was Amazon who commissioned it. But I believe it's now been dropped. But that would have been quite fascinating to see, you know, how that came out, because some US shows like The Office, obviously, I mean, they're different, but can be very good. So,
I mean, this did remind me a lot of the UK Office and even a fair bit of the spin-off film, David Brent's like Life on the Road, which I know didn't get great reviews, but I quite liked that when I saw it, you know, and it sort of reminded me of that in the way, and that it's got that bit of kind of pathos as well. And as well as it plays on that mock doc style as well, and gets a lot of laughs the way it uses the format.
Yeah, it's not as sort of screamingly funny as, say, the Inbetweeners movies, which the Inbetweeners TV show is pretty funny, but then the movies kind of really seem to ramp that up. They seem to really work on the big screen. It's not quite that level of gut-busting, laugh-out-loud humour, but there's enough to kind of make you smile all the way through. I mean, I was never was never bored in it. No. It was, you know, it clips along at a nice pace, and the characters are all exactly as you know them from the show. I mean, Asim Chowdhury's manager, Chabadi G, as Jamie said at the beginning, he's kind of living out of a van, which is kind of how he ends the fifth season. So it's been a pretty bleak time for him in the last 3 years. I mean, he's a sort of tragicomic figure of the entire show. And they give him some little victories here as well, which I think was quite nice. Mm-hmm. They don't just completely kick him when he's down. So I think everyone gets their moment in the sun. I mean, Steve's as well, the permanently stoned guy played by Steve Stamp, who's the kind of co-creator of the show. He has a real interesting arc because he actually finds a girlfriend, which is pretty unusual for him. So that was quite sweet as well. So there's a lot of sweetness to it, which I think fans will enjoy.
One bit that really did make me laugh out loud, basically the guy who's kind of forget on purpose to get a ticket to Japan for MC Grinder's girlfriend, Mish. They want it to be a kind of boys' trip, so they deliberately forget to get her a ticket, so she has to go back home from the airport. She's not going, but she's already told everyone on the internet, as she says, that she's going to Japan. So rather than then let everyone on the internet know she's not going, she basically has to fake it, so she goes around her mate's house to live for a couple of weeks because she can't go home, but she has to keep her face. And when she gets there, the first thing she says is like, oh, have you got any chopsticks? She's gonna like live this lie that she's out in Japan. And I found that very funny and very, very true. These kind of fake lives people live online, showing your best side.
Yeah, there was a lot of funny elements like that, but I agree with James that it's sort of, and especially with you, Jamie, talking about Hot Fuzz earlier as well, that it kind of lacked any of those like real sort of, you know, that laughs that you'll remember for like years to come, and like huge kind of set piece laughs. But it was very kind of chucklesome throughout. So that was People Just Do Nothing Big in Japan, which is also out in cinemas right now. So you can go and see it right away if you want to. Time Enough for Plain Talking, where we discuss, you know, like a filmmaking term that you may not know the meaning of. This week, we're looking at aspect ratio. Guys, does one of you want to tell me what an aspect ratio is?
Yeah, aspect ratio is the format the screen comes in. And we have different versions of that. You could sometimes see filmmakers using a kind of boxed off aspect ratio, or this more of a widescreen aspect ratio. So yeah, it's just a different versions of how film is presented.
Yeah, so the ratio is just literally, when they say ratio, they mean the kind of width to height, where 1:1 would be like a square, you know, and anything else like, you know, 16:9 is more of a widescreen. But Jamie, how does kind of filmmakers use aspect ratios in different ways? What could people kind of look out for?
Well, it kind of all started to change in round about the 1950s, because up until then, the classic aspect ratio was 4:3, which is kind of a box shape, and all the old classic movies were shot like that. And then in the 50s, and it was kind of a reaction to television and wanting to provide something that TV viewers wouldn't get. They started to change the format and you started to get widescreen. So you got these big kind of cinema scope epics where you really felt you were getting more bang for your buck, these huge vistas. So then you started to get in 16:9 and stuff like that. And they've played with it over the years. I would say the way filmmakers use it now is people do tend to go back to 4:3 often when they want to get a really sort of claustrophobic feel. They can use it for that. You can even get narrower than that. But there was a film came out a few years ago called Mommy, a French film, and that was shot almost like it was on a mobile phone. So it was really, really hemmed in, and you had all these scenes of domestic arguments and stuff, and you felt like you were trapped in there with them. And then you can obviously use a bigger, wider screen for spectacle and vistas, like big science fiction films or huge westerns or anything like that. So you can kind of tailor it to your needs.
There you have it. That's what we mean when we talk about an aspect ratio. Now, time to draw the curtains for another horror film.
My husband took the boat out on the lake. He took a handgun that I didn't even know that we owned, and
did he leave a note?
He did. You were right. There is nothing. Nothing is after you. You're safe now.
You said you were safe? Safe from what?
That was a trailer for The Night House. James, what is The Night House and who lives there?
Well, it stars Rebecca Hall as Beth, who is a teacher in terrible grief. Her husband has just killed himself with a gun that she didn't even know they possessed. She's obviously completely traumatized. She's still living in this kind of lakeside house that sort of he built for her. As it goes on, she gradually starts to, first of all, uncover things about his life. I mean, really, never go looking in, you know, through mobile phones and old photographs and things. You're bound to find stuff you don't want to know about. But on top of that, sort of, she's also kind of being seemingly haunted by some sort of presence at the house, which she kind of considers perhaps is her husband, Owen. Simultaneously, as I said, she's finding out more and more about his life. There's a very strange photograph of a woman that seems a bit like her in a kind of library by a bookshelf. And the more she discovers this photograph, that she realizes that perhaps his life was not all on the level. There was a lot she didn't know about him. So it's really a kind of journey of discovery, finding out more about your deceased loved one and perhaps things you didn't really want to find out.
So, Jamie, you're a big horror fan. What did you think of this film?
I thought the first half was really well done. Like James says, it's sort of partly a mystery story, partly a haunted house movie. And the director, David Bruckner, who did The Ritual a few years ago, which I absolutely loved, he's very good at basically building suspense. There's several sequences where it's the usual thing where she's padding around the house at night, hearing noises or music comes on suddenly in the middle of the night. And without resorting to very cheap Blair kind of jump scares, he's just very good at building suspense, and you kind of feel that shiver of terror. So I found it really, really intriguing. Then the second half, when things begin to be revealed, and I don't want to say anything here because I don't want to give anything away, but it kind of goes in a territory which I found didn't quite hang together. You can kind of poke at it and a whole house of cards comes tumbling down. So overall, by the end, I felt faintly disappointed. But having said that, I think he is a director within the genre of real note who has made a very good film in The Ritual and would go on to make other very good films. And I think Rebecca Hall is absolutely terrific in it. She sells it that a lot of the film, she's just on her own on the screen, that she is just padding around. And it's that typical thing of sort of, you know, the woman in peril. But she does it so well, and she brings dimensions to the character you often don't get in female characters in films, that she's not afraid to be quite unlikable, that she's suffering this grief and she's very closed off and she's cold and she can be cruel at times. She manages to do all of that without ever apologising for it, and yet you still care very, very deeply for this character. So I thought that was very good.
Yeah, I really did like that bit early on where you're talking about her being unlikable, where a mother of one of her pupils comes in sort of wanting her grade, her sort of child's grade to be boosted upwards. Yeah. And then she's kind of like, yeah, you know what? My husband just killed himself. I don't care a thing about your child's grade. You can have a B, you can have an A, I don't care. I think Rebecca Hall really played those scenes really, really well. It sort of faltered in the second half for me, kind of like Jamie was saying. I was a little bit bored by a lot of the revelations. I really like Stacey Martin pops up as well, the young actress who was in Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac. I always like watching her. She was she's a really intriguing, almost sort of Hitchcockian kind of presence. I almost felt there was almost too much going on in the film, or he was trying to do too many things, David Bruckner, and it. You know, there are almost different horror aspects that are being melded together that didn't quite come off for me in the end. Definitely an ambitious work and definitely a good showcase for Rebecca Hall. Didn't quite pull it together for me.
Yeah, I'm kind of inclined to agree with both you guys. I thought it was an absolutely amazing performance from Rebecca Hall. But yeah, I wasn't entirely convinced by the sort of third act. And at times I didn't think the rest of the cast were as good as her. There were times where kind of some of the supporting players let it down a little bit. And I mean, come on, there's no way I could live in a house with that much kind of glass around it. Like, I would have to have the curtains pulled at night at all times, you know.
Yeah, that's not a horror movie though, is it? You know, having things like curtains. Yeah.
I will say, I mean, again, we talked earlier in this podcast about, you know, it can be unfair to compare films to classics and stuff, but this is another film, and we've had a lot of them recently, where it's a female-centric horror film, it's a female story, and it's based on someone who's suffering grief, and, you know, there's a lot of trauma there, and it's sort of dealing with real-world horror, bringing the supernatural on top of them. So naturally, you immediately think of things like Hereditary, and you think of things like The Babadook, and again, it falls well short of those. The first half is very decent, the second half kind of loses it a bit, and it's certainly no classic like those two are.
So that's The Night House, which is in cinemas from this Friday, 20th of August. And finally, it's time to uncage an animal.
I'm looking for a truffle pig. Someone stole her.
I don't understand.
Tell him who you are.
You made the right choice, being out there in the woods. There's nothing here for you anymore. There's really nothing here for most of us. Buy yourself a new pig.
That was Pig. Jamie, set up Pig for us.
Pig is about a man who lives in the wilderness called Rob, and he's played by Nicolas Cage, and he just lives out in a shack in the middle of the kind of Oregon wood, and his only companion is his faithful pig, who he absolutely adores, and who is very important to allow him to survive, because this pig goes out, sniffs for truffles, finds the truffles, and then the only contact Rob has with the outside world is once a week, Amir, who's played by Alex Wolff, comes along, buys these truffles off him and takes them into Portland, where obviously, you know, they're used in lovely cuisine and sell for a lot of money. So that's how the story is progressing for the first 10 minutes or so. And then the pig is kidnapped. But late at night, two men burst into the house, steal the pig, which obviously upsets Rob a great deal. It's his only companion in life. And Rob decides to try and get his pig back. So he drives into Portland with Amir and starts looking for his pig. And it's a very strange film that it kind of takes you into this almost subterranean world of a high cuisine where, you know, you wouldn't expect it, but there's all sorts of nasty things going on and corruption and all of this. And what is interesting about this film is just from the plot line, you expect it to be a typical Nick Cage film of the last 10 years where he's absolutely bonkers and he goes on a mad roaring rampage of revenge. And it's not like that at all, but it's played very steady and controlled. And again, is another film that deals with grief. He's mourning the loss of his pig, and it's a very internal performance. So I'll hand it over to James. What did you think, James?
Absolutely love this film. Exactly for the reasons you just said, is that someone had sold it to me, or I'd read online that this is John Wick with a pig. And I can see why someone would say that, because in obviously John Wick, Keanu's character goes on this kind of rampage because someone kidnaps his dog, which meant a great deal to him. So there's a sort of superficial similarity there. But the cage rampage doesn't quite materialize here. And the film is all the better for it, really. It's an extremely sort of taciturn performance from Cage. He's extremely buttoned down. He barely says anything for the sort of first sort of 15 minutes or so. And then, as Jamie said, this kind of bizarre subterranean high cuisine cult is just brilliantly done. I mean, at one point it goes very, very Fight Club, which is very, very strange. And you sort of see these kind of chefs or waiters or whatever they are, kind of all beating each other up, you know, for money down below in this kind of basement of this hotel. That's really strange. They don't really come back to that. And I kind of wish they'd explored that a bit further. So there were some elements they could have pushed further. There's like one incredible scene where Cage and Alex Wolff's characters are in this sort of high-end restaurant, and they're sort of confronting this chef that has some connection, let's say, to Cage's character from the past. And it's such a bizarre performance from the guy who plays the chef. He's just sort of laughing extremely uncomfortably all the way through the scene. There's just so many kind of like weird little moments in this film that I really, really enjoyed. The choices they made in as actors, and obviously the choices the director made as well. This is my favorite film of the week. Oh, wow. Anyway.
Okay. I haven't actually seen that one yet, so this has gone right to the top of my need to see list. And so that was Pig, which has just opened the Edinburgh Film Festival and is in cinemas from Friday the 20th of August. And then it's available on altitude.film and other digital platforms from Monday. So before we go, just time for a reader's question. Which movie animal would you most like as a pet?
I'm a big cat lover. I went for Ulysses, the ginger cat in Inside Llewyn Davis, who's constantly giving Llewyn Davis a hard time.
Well, I'd be very tempted to go for the pig in this film, Pig, because he is absolutely adorable. But I then read that because the film was so low budget, they couldn't afford a trained pig. So they had to just get a normal pig for this film. And he kept biting Nicolas Cage, apparently. So maybe I shouldn't go for that one. So I'm going to go for another pig in the movies. I'm going to go for Gunda, who was the star of a documentary released earlier this year, which is absolutely wonderful, executive produced by Joaquin Phoenix. And this pig, I won't give anything away, but it undergoes a fair bit of trauma in the film, and you absolutely fall in love with her. She's just this big sow, and she's so beautiful. So I want to bring her home and just basically look after her and tell her everything's all right. So I'm going to go for Gunda.
Okay. What about you, Matt?
I was actually going to go for Gizmo from Gremlins, just because he's just so damn cute and I've always loved him. But now with your answer, I feel like maybe I'm cheating by going for a sort of fantasy creature. So I'm trying to think of a real animal that I'd go for, but probably the one that springs to mind would be another ginger cat, Jonesy from Alien, just because
good choice.
He's just so cute, so sort of resourceful and resilient. So I think, yeah, I'd give him a good home back on Earth. So
good man.
So again, pretty much that's all we've got time for today, but must urge you to check out the new issue of Turtle Film, which is out this Friday, 20th of August, with Dune on the cover. It's got an absolutely massive Dune cover story inside, 20 pages of Dune access with, you know, interviews with everyone in it. Plus, there's also Shang-Chi. Jamie's interviewed Steve Martin and Martin Short. James has spoken to Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson about No Time to Die. I had a big career interview with Richard E. Grant. There's just absolutely loads in this issue. So please, I do urge you to check it out when it comes out this Friday.
I've got to say, Matt, it was actually your career interview with Richard E. Grant that sent me back to Withnail, because I'm not just saying this to anyone listening, and it is such a good interview, like career interview, and Richard E. Grant is so frank and funny and tells great stories. And I read that and just thought, I need some Richard E. Grant in my life. So where better to go than back to the beginning? his first ever role. It just beggars belief, really. It's just stunning.
Yeah, it's an absolutely insane debut, isn't it? But yes, thanks for saying that. But yeah, everyone, please check it out. And there's just now time for us to all just say bye. Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Cake and fine wine.
If you don't leave, we'll call the police.
Balls. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now.